And a pleasant day to you today. Wednesday it is. The 13th of May. It's 45 seconds away from noon. Thanks for tuning in. This is Public Radio KMXT Kodiak, 100.1 FM, live on the web, kmxt.org. Welcome to the Villages. K269AW Larson Bay, K269AX Carlock, K269AY Akiak, K269AZ Old Harbor, and K220AU in Port Lyons are our translators. 50 beautiful degrees out at the airport. We're 53 up here on Signal Hill. 68% humidity with a northeast wind at 8 miles an hour blowing and 10 miles of visibility at the airport. Partly sunny skies today with a high near 54. West winds 5 miles an hour, becoming calm later in the afternoon. Cloudy tonight, a low around 43. Calm winds become north 5 miles an hour. Cloudy tomorrow, but a high in the 50s again with south winds only 5 miles an hour. Pretty nice day. Nice day for all of our visitors who are here. Welcome to you if you are listening. Our marine forecast for Chiniac Bay, we should have variable winds of 10 knots with 3 foot seas this afternoon. Variable less than 10, becoming south 10 after midnight tonight, 2 foot seas. Southeast 10, 3 foot seas on Thursday. Marmot Bay, west winds of 15, 3 foot seas this afternoon. Southwest 10, becoming variable less than 10 with seas of 2 feet tonight. And southeast winds of 10 knots with 3 foot seas tomorrow. News in the bunker. That's what you're looking forward to. First, we'll start with NPR news headlines. And then we'll go into some local and statewide news. Willie B. with another edition of The Bunker at 12:30.
NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The FBI says it's investigating suspected Chinese hacking efforts that target U.S. organizations working on a vaccine for coronavirus or treatment for the disease COVID-19. NPR's Greg Myrie reports on the latest development deepening the dispute between the world's biggest economies.
The FBI says it's looking into hackers believed to be linked to the Chinese government. The agency says the hackers are attempting to, quote, identify and illicitly obtain valuable intellectual property related to vaccines, treatments, and testing. The FBI statement did not provide additional details, but U.S. officials have said the targets include pharmaceutical companies, university research hospitals, and government health agencies. The announcement is likely to further increase tensions in the already strained U.S.-China relationship. China denies that it steals U.S. technology, but U.S. officials describe it as a major ongoing effort. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. is tracking the response to new coronavirus cases in parts of Asia that were thought to have gotten over the worst of the pandemic, but now fear a second wave. New cases in China reportedly are prompting coronavirus testing in Wuhan on all 11 million residents within 10 days. In South Korea, officials are scrambling to find and test thousands of people in connection with a cluster of new infections linked to a handful of nightclubs and bars in Seoul. The head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, is condemning yesterday's militant attack on a maternity hospital in Afghanistan.
I was shocked and appalled to hear of the attack on an MSF hospital in Afghanistan, which led to the deaths of nurses, mothers, and babies. Civilians and health workers should never be a target.
At least 16 people were killed. U.S. markets are ending the day sharply lower. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell warned today that it could take the U.S. economy a long time to recover from the coronavirus pandemic. We have this from NPR's Scott Horsley.
Powell says the scope and speed of the economic downturn are without precedent. And while he says the economy should recover once the virus is under control, Powell warns many small businesses may not survive that long without additional financial help from the federal government. Powell says such help could be costly, but worth it to prevent more lasting economic damage. The sobering assessment from the central bank chief rattled investors and sent all the major stock indexes down. Powell says while the pain caused by the pandemic is widespread, lower-income households have been hit especially hard. A new Fed survey shows nearly 40% of workers in households making less than $40,000 a year were laid off in March. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow has closed down more than 2%. This is NPR.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
Time for the Midday Report.
Today's KMXT local news is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
We'll start out, if you have not heard, about the issuance of Health Mandate 18 yesterday. The governor with the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has issued State of Alaska's 18th COVID health mandate on intrastate travel. COVID-19 Health Mandate 18 permits travel between communities on the road system and in-state travel in the Alaska Marine Highway System. Travel continues to be prohibited to communities off the road system not served by the Alaska Marine Highway System, except for travel supporting critical infrastructure or critical personal needs. And reviewing all health mandates, monitoring the evolving COVID-19 case data, and acknowledging the need for clarity, the governor said he is easing the restrictions on intrastate travel on the road system and community service by the ferry by issuing Mandate 18. The hard work of all Alaskans over the past several months has significantly stalled the spread of the virus, allowing us to methodically reopen pieces of our economy. Again, that means you can travel by plane or by ferry without restrictions from our community, since we're on the Marine Highway System. You can check out the governor's, the state's website for further information about that. We may have some more information about that tomorrow during the ESC meeting. The next step in the state's reopening plan went into effect on Friday. The second phase expanded the list of businesses allowed to reopen in a limited capacity to include bars, gyms, and theaters. The state's daily count of new COVID-19 cases remains low for more than 3 weeks. The average has hovered around 2 new cases each day. Still, officials warn that while the virus may not be spreading as quickly as it was in March and early April, the risk of transmission is still present. Despite the go-ahead, the limitations on reopening and subsequent risk to the community have led some Kodiak business owners to hold off.
We are able to open, but I'm not really ready to pull the trigger yet.
As Tracy Chandler, owner of the exercise studio A Balanced Approach, she closed up shop 2 days before the governor mandated closures for all non-essential businesses. Under Phase 2, Chandler can resume her exercise classes as long as she stays at 25% capacity and keeps students 10 feet apart. She said she's still figuring out how to make that work.
It'll be a juggling act. It would mostly be for human contact and for just to get people motivated again. And, you know, that sense of community that we have there, it wouldn't be a big moneymaker, but I think it's worth doing.
The process of putting together a mitigation plan and complying with strict state guidelines is complicated. Chandler said it's been a slog.
I'm toggling between those two kind of. I don't know if it's responsibility or slight laziness, but I'm kind of dragging my feet because I feel like I'm going to jump through all these hoops and then they're just going to open it all up. Some days it's just, I don't want to deal with it.
In the meantime, she said she held her first outdoor socially distanced kickboxing class this weekend. Past weekend outside, she's allowed to have 19 students with one instructor. She said she's hoping to have some small classes in her studio starting next week. Hopefully we'll have more information about that tomorrow on the Lowdown. Here's a story from Juneau.
After 3 weeks without any new reported cases of COVID-19, Juneau has 2 new cases, according to the Alaska Department of Health and Human Services. According to a press release from the city and borough of Juneau, both cases are a result of secondary transmission, meaning they were in close contact with someone who tested positive. Charlie Gribben is an infectious disease preventionist with Bartlett Regional Hospital.
The infection incubation period is 2 weeks, but you could kind of catch it at the tail end and then develop it another 2 weeks later. So I think we're not in the clear past 5 weeks past the last infection, depending on what's going on with the asymptomatic spread.
Gribben confirmed the new cases are a 54-year-old male and a 53-year-old female. She reminds Junoites to continue practicing distancing measures. Don't share space with people who are not in your household and wear a mask.
When you are inside in a restaurant, in a church, in any place inside, and you're breathing the same air as other people, you've got to keep a face covering on.
Gribben says that the more people are maximizing space, the safer they'll be. Since the first case in Juneau was confirmed in March, 29 people in the borough have tested positive for COVID-19. 26 of those cases have recovered.
From Abby Collins. Governor Mike Dunleavy's administration began distributing federal CARES Act funds to communities, small businesses, and nonprofits yesterday. And while Alaska's municipalities have said they're eager for the money, many are concerned there won't be enough. Cities and towns are facing hundreds of millions of dollars in extra spending and lost revenue due to the pandemic. Alaska Public Media and K2's Andrew Kitchiman reports.
In the lead-up to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee approving more than $1 billion in CARES Act relief, lawmakers heard from Alaska's mayors and local leaders. Each had unique news to share, and it was stark.
I'm afraid we're going to be facing closing of businesses and out-migration of people and just a collapse in the social systems here.
That's Calvin Cassapit, mayor of Gustavus. The Southeast City depends on tourists for its revenue. He's concerned that the federal restrictions on the $630,000 the city is set to receive through the CARES Act means the money won't meet Gustavus's needs.
The impact has been on our revenues, and since we can't use the CARES Act for replacement of revenues, we're in a tough situation right now.
One of the stipulations from the U.S. Treasury is that the money can't be spent for programs that were already budgeted, but it can be spent on public safety and public health. And for many Alaska boroughs and cities, spending on police is the biggest item. But the strings attached to the CARES Act money may not be the biggest problem they're facing. For a lot of places, the funds won't be enough to cover total unanticipated spending and lost revenue. The Alaska Municipal League estimates the gap at roughly $500 million through the end of 2020. Communities don't know now what they're going to need to spend later. Dillingham faces a particularly extreme situation.
We're extremely concerned about our healthcare capacity and our capabilities. Our residents here are very anxious.
That's city manager Todd Larson. Dillingham is facing a surge in population for the commercial salmon fishery. And Larson says city leaders don't know how much the city will have to spend to prevent or respond to a COVID-19 outbreak.
It's been extremely challenging already, and we've been through about a month, and I'm looking at three more months, so I'm only a quarter done. I'm exhausted already.
The practical problems raised by the epidemic are raising the urgency for infrastructure projects in some communities. Bethel City Manager Vincenzo Vinny Carraza says local residents depend on water being hauled to them, and the truck drivers could become sick if there's an outbreak.
So having a pipe system, water system, is the answer. You don't need to rely on drivers. It's piped to people's homes. And I think we would use our CARES funding to start converting our hauled areas to a pipe system.
That's the plan, but there are still questions. Alaska Municipal League Executive Director Nils Andreasen says Bethel's not the only community considering water infrastructure upgrades.
It's great that health mandate says we should wash our hands more. We don't have running water. Is that an allowable expenditure? I hope so. I hope that we can see improvements in our water, wastewater, sanitation.
While Andreasen says the CARES Act relief is essential, the total costs will pressure municipalities.
Municipalities are approaching, they're spending from savings. Some have furloughs that are implemented. You've got this reallocation of staff time. You've got closed facilities that were revenue generating that aren't now, plus the lost tax revenue from economic constriction.
And this is happening as local elected officials are writing budgets. Andreasen hopes the legislature and Dunleavy can agree on additional state aid for municipalities, but he acknowledges that the state has its own budget problems. Congress is another potential source for help, but the outcome there is uncertain. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Thank you, Andrew. Alaska Air and Grant Aviation will begin regular flights between Unalaska and Anchorage this coming weekend. Grant Aviation announced yesterday they'll be offering passenger service between Unalaska and Cold Bay. From there, Alaska Airlines will connect to Anchorage. The new nonstop service will be flown twice a week on Wednesdays and Saturdays. Alaska Air announced last month it would begin serving Cold Bay after Raven Group, the only commercial airline serving Unalaska, grounded flights and filed for bankruptcy in early April. Since then, Unalaskans have had to rely on charter service to get to and from the island. This week in water.
Are we passing the threshold of human survivability? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Extremely hot and humid conditions occur twice as often now as they did 40 years ago around the world, and the severity is increasing.
In a new study, scientists at Columbia University have shown that the combination of heat and humidity, which can often be fatal, is already passing the threshold of what humans can survive in some places.
Humidity diminishes the body's ability to cool itself through sweating. When conditions reach a certain point, outdoor activities are virtually impossible.
The new research looked at hourly data from more than 7,800 weather stations around the planet. In addition to temperature and humidity, the scientists incorporated wind speed and solar radiation in a measurement called the wet bulb index, which, if above 90 degrees Fahrenheit, will stress a human working or exercising in the sun in 15 minutes.
Scientists widely accept 95 degrees as the highest wet bulb temperature a person can withstand.
The new research concluded that there are many vulnerable locations around the world, including the coasts of Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi.
Last week, President Trump signed an executive order directing his administration to strengthen the offshore fish farming industry by speeding up environmental impact statements and reviews.
The move is meant to strengthen aquaculture of fish and shellfish, often raised in nets or pens in the ocean.
A food industry group called Stronger America Through Seafood, which has been trying to expand fish farming, supported the announcement. In a statement, the group, sponsored by Red Lobster and Cargill, among others, said Trump's order will clarify regulations and reduce barriers that limit offshore aquaculture.
But there was widespread criticism from environmental groups. Friends of the Earth said in a statement that the move threatens ocean ecosystems and coastal economies.
Offshore aquaculture facilities use giant floating cages, allowing toxic pollution, including pesticides and antibiotics, to flow into open waters, threatening wild fish.
Environmental attorney Marianne Caffone said the federal government should strengthen local food security during the COVID-19 crisis by supporting sustainable seafood rather than allowing corporations to pollute the ecosystems we depend on.
The official start of the hurricane season is June 1st, and it's forecast to be worse than usual.
If an area is hit, preparing and responding will be more challenging with the COVID-19 pandemic because it will be difficult to evacuate targeted areas and to shelter people while social distancing.
But now Earther reports a new wrinkle has emerged. The virus appears to be spread through human feces, raising the possibility that heavy storms could damage infrastructure meant to contain waste.
Studies have found COVID-19 in the feces of patients and in their guts. In one case, it was found in a person's feces 33 days after their respiratory samples tested negative.
Hurricanes have been known to overwhelm wastewater plants. With heavy rain and storm surges, winds can knock out power to treatment facilities, leading to sewage backups into streets, which now could possibly carry the virus.
Snowpack in the U.S. West is melting earlier this year. The Washington Post reports that in some parts of California, snow cover could be completely gone more than a month earlier than average.
In Colorado, recent warm temperatures have led to an unusual loss of nearly half the snowpack in about the last 2 weeks.
The rapid melting will fill reservoirs earlier than usual, but it could also dry out the ground and vegetation more quickly, increasing the danger of wildfires.
Firefighters in California California gathered last week to prepare, and they made it clear that the summer would not mimic last year when wildfires remained small and manageable into August. Officials there were urging the public to prepare for wildfires by clearing brush and reviewing evacuation plans, especially while staying home due to the pandemic.
The U.S. Drought Monitor indicated that in Colorado, more than 60% of the state was in drought conditions, and more than three-quarters is abnormally dry.
As the Denver Post reports, the good news is that the conditions probably won't lead to any significant flooding, which typically occur with rapid snowmelt and heavy rain events.
Finally, toxic algal blooms are a serious problem created when runoff from fertilizers and other pollutants send high amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus into waterways.
But nitrogen and phosphorus are exactly the ingredients that marijuana growers need for their plants. So after seeing a severe algal bloom kill more than 200 manatees in his part of Southwest Florida, Steve Edmonds got an idea.
Why not grow hemp plants, the non-intoxicating version of cannabis, to suck the nutrients out of Florida's lakes and rivers?
Edmonds pitched the idea to researchers at South Florida State College, and they're launching a pilot project to determine just how much nitrogen and phosphorus a single hemp plant could absorb.
To conduct their study, 2 4-foot-wide hydroponic biomats will be anchored in a lake near the college and float on top of the water away from other vegetation. The hemp roots will hang in the water and absorb the nutrients.
After filtering the lake, the hemp can be harvested and used in a range of items from textiles and beauty products to dietary supplements and biodegradable plastics.
In addition, according to a news release from the college, hemp can be used as a source of renewable energy and can be made into a non-toxic, fireproof, and mold-resistant building material like hempcrete that weighs far less than concrete.
It will be the first bioremediation project using hemp on waterways in the U.S. Edmonds, who is the founder of Hemp for Water, hopes the process could be scaled up to restore the highly contaminated Lake Okeechobee.
It could also save a lot of money used to clean waterways and could introduce a new estimated $35 billion crop to the state.
That's it for this week in Water. We'll see you next time.
Great show. You learn a lot just listening to that little 6-minute piece every week. Fish Radio for today.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Alaska halibut gets battered at both fresh and now frozen markets. More after this.
Grundins urges everyone to buy seafood directly from community-supported fisheries at localcatch.org. Grundins, supporting fisheries around the world since 1926.
Sales of Alaska's most popular seafoods are being hit hard by markets upended by the coronavirus, but perhaps none is getting battered worse than halibut. Starting 3 years ago, sales of fresh Pacific halibut to East Coast markets were toppled by a flood of less expensive fish flowing in mostly from eastern Canada. Trade data show that for 2019 through February 2020, total Canadian halibut imports topped 15 million pounds, for which the U.S. paid $107 million. Earlier this year, fresh farmed Atlantic halibut from Norway was spotted for sale at $9.99 a pound at a Costco near Seattle. Now, Alaska halibut is taking a huge hit in the West Coast frozen market from halibut caught by Russians and processed into fillets in China. The fish then goes to the U.S. and Canada for resale at prices that undercut all others. The Russia-China sales are relatively new but growing fast, says economist Garrett Everidge at the McDowell Group. Last year, it totaled 2 million pounds in the U.S. at a cost of nearly $7 million.
For a relatively low-volume fishery and market, like the halibut market in the U.S., you know, 2 million pounds is pretty material.
Most of the halibut comes in through Vancouver to sidestep the ongoing 25% tariffs between the U.S. and China. Everidge says the fish sales also benefit from currency exchange rates that favor the foreign countries.
The Russian ruble has actually weakened against the U.S. dollar about 14%. So what that effectively means is if I'm a U.S. buyer, there's a 14% discount.
Meanwhile, Russia has not purchased a single pound of U.S. seafood since 2014. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by Ocean Beauty Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch. Fish Radio is supported in part by Joy Crafts, specializing in marine safety equipment. U.S. Coast Guard approved AMC instruction for commercial fishing vessel safety procedures and drills, serving Kodiak for over 25 years. 486-6293 at 445 Shahafka Circle.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Currently 50 degrees at the airport with fair skies, 68% humidity, and northeast wind at 8 miles an hour blowing, 10 miles visibility. Partly sunny this afternoon with a high near 54, west winds around 5 miles an hour becoming calm in the afternoon. Tonight mostly cloudy, a low around 43, calm winds become north 5 miles an hour, cloudy with a high near 51 and south winds of 5 miles an hour on Thursday. 13th of May today, 5:50 a.m. was when the sun came up, goes down at 10:24, 16 hours and 35 minutes of daylight today, 4 minutes and 10 seconds more than we had yesterday. We got up to 74 as a high in 1968, 29 in 2012 was the record low. The synopsis, high pressure persists over the Gulf through late Thursday night. A front approaches the southern Gulf late Thursday night. West of the Barrens, including Kamishak Bay, west 15 6-foot seas this afternoon, south 15 4-foot seas tonight, southeast 15 5-foot seas tomorrow. Barren Islands east, west 27-foot seas this afternoon, southwest 27-foot seas tonight, east 15 3-foot seas tomorrow. Myron Island to Sitkanak, southwest 15 4-foot seas this afternoon, south 15 4-foot seas tonight, northeast 26-foot seas tomorrow. Chiniak Bay, variable winds at 10 knots this afternoon with 3-foot seas, variable less than 10 becoming south 10 after midnight, 2-foot seas tonight, southeast 10, 3-foot seas tomorrow. Marmot Bay this afternoon, west winds of 15, 3-foot seas, southwest 10 becoming variable less than 10, 2-foot seas tonight, southeast 10, 3-foot seas tomorrow. Shelikov Strait this afternoon, southwest 26-foot seas, southwest 15, 4-foot seas tonight, variable 10 becoming northeast 15 in the afternoon, seas of 4 feet tomorrow. Next tide in the Kodiak District's a low tide at 139.34 feet. Evening high tides at 840, 6.09 feet. The Uganic tides at 203 this afternoon, 1.2 feet. And the evening high tides at just before 9 o'clock. It's about an 11.5-foot tide. Some announcements. The Alaskan Department of Fish and Game Division of Sport Fish will be hosting their second online fishing forum titled King Salmon Fishing 101 on the Alaska Department of Fish and Game YouTube channel. Presentation will go through salmon identification, ethical angling practices, how to fish for king salmon in fresh and salt water throughout the state. The fishing forum will be available on YouTube tonight at 6:05. ADF&G staff will be available to answer any questions in real time from 6 to 8 in the YouTube chat and in the Facebook event chat. If it's a free event, for more information, contact the forum organizer, Molly McCarthy, Cunfer, at 444-6030. That's tonight. Get ready for fishing. That sounds like fun. Do you need a cloth mask? The ESC is providing free cloth masks for the public while they last. The masks are being distributed every Monday and Friday from 11 to 1 in front of the auditorium by volunteers of the Kodiak Community Support Team. So if you still need one, Friday is a good day to go stand out there in front of the auditorium. Kodiak Public Library has Zoom Room Book Club on Friday for 3 o'clock. Meet up online to discuss what you've read, watched, or listened to recently from print to podcast. Send an email to lmadson@city.kodiak.ak.us to receive a Zoom invitation. On Saturday, 11 o'clock, the public library is hosting a garden party. Come help them dig, weed, plant, and prepare their garden for summer. Staggered arrivals are appreciated to maintain distances. For more information about this, call the library, 486-8686. The Kodiak Audubon Society is celebrating World Migratory Bird Day on the 16th. The events are a Zoom meeting at 9 o'clock in the morning from 9 to 9:45 from Kodiak to Indonesia, The Migration of Aleutian Terns. It's a presentation by Jill Tengeris of Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge and Oregon State University. Join as they join virtually from the comfort of your home with a cup of coffee while Jill will share the work she's been doing here in Kodiak that fits in nicely with the 2020 World Migratory Bird Day conservation theme, Birds Connect Our World. It focuses on the tracking techniques used to explore the routes of migratory birds across the globe and how to this knowledge is used to inform conservation. Contact KodiakAudubon at gmail.com for a direct link. And then at 10 o'clock, they're kicking off Beaches and Birding Challenge. Since large groups activities aren't possible, they're offering a 10 Beaches and Birding Challenge to encourage families to visit Kodiak's beaches and look for our feathered friends throughout the summer. The challenge runs from the 16th through September 7th. Audubon will be providing participants with a packet that contains the guide with the 10 beach locations and photographs of the most likely birds you'll see in Kodiak. In addition, each kit will have a notebook passbook to record information about each bird and a beach. It sounds like a great project. Send an email to kodiakaudubon@gmail.com and indicate if you prefer a packet mailed to you or if you want to pick it up in person at their ferry office on the 16th between 10 and noon, and wear a mask. You can sign up after the 16th also if you would like.